life of the family here in the States. She would have to find a house, get Cheryl, Cindy, and Glenn Jr. into schools, buy or rent some furniture. Carolyn was kind of a dependent person. She would not find it easy. Plus, she was already mad at him. She had come to Dallas with him that morning, but Scully had told him to send her home. She was not permitted to check into the Hilton Inn with her husband. That had made her angry. But Paul and Bill had wives and families, too. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. It was in the Bible twice, Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, and Matthew's Gospel chapter 19, verse 19. Jackson thought, if I was stuck in jail in Tehran, I'd sure love for somebody to do something for me. So he volunteered. Scully had made his choice days ago. Before Perot started talking about a rescue, Scully had been discussing the idea. It had first come up the day after Paul and Bill were arrested, the day Scully flew out of Tehran with Joe Pesci and Jim Schwabach. Scully had been upset at leaving Paul and Bill behind, all the more so because Tehran had become dramatically more violent in the last few days. At Christmas, two Afghanis caught stealing in the bazaar had been summarily hanged by a mob, and a taxi driver who had tried to jump the queue at a gas station had been shot in the head by a soldier. What would they do to Americans once they got started? It hardly bore thinking about. On the plane, Scully had sat next to Jim Schwabach. They had agreed that Paul's and Bill's lives were in danger. Schwabach, who had experience of clandestine commando-type operations, had agreed with Scully that it should be possible for a few determined Americans to rescue two men from an Iranian jail. So Scully had been surprised and delighted when, 3 days later, Perot had said, I've been thinking the same thing. Scully had put his own name on the list. He did not need time to think about it. He volunteered. Scully had also put Coburn's name on the list without telling Coburn. Until this moment, happy-go-lucky Coburn, who lived from day to day, had not even thought about being on the team himself. But Scully had been right. Coburn wanted to go. He thought, Liz won't like it. He sighed. There were many things his wife did not like these days. She was clinging, he thought. She had not liked his being in the military. She did not like his having hobbies that took him away from her. She did not like his working for a boss who felt free to call on him at all hours of the day or night for special tasks. He had never lived the way she wanted, and it was probably too late to start now. If he went to Tehran to rescue Paul and Bill, Liz might hate him for it. But if he did not go, he would probably hate her for making him stay behind. Sorry, Liz, he thought. Here we go again. Jim Schwabach arrived later in the afternoon, but heard the same speech from Perot. Schwabach had a highly developed sense of duty. He had once wanted to be a priest, but 2 years in a Catholic seminary had soured him on organized religion. He had spent 11 years in the army and had volunteered for repeated tours in Vietnam out of that same sense of duty. In Asia, he had seen a lot of people doing their jobs badly, and he knew he did his well. He had thought, if I walk away from this, someone else will do what I'm doing, but he will do it badly. And in consequence, a man will lose his arm, his leg, or his life. I've been trained to do this, and I'm good at it, and I owe it to them to carry on doing it. He felt much the same about the rescue of Paul and Bill. He was the only member of the proposed team who had actually done this sort of thing before. They needed him. Anyway, he liked it. He was a fighter by disposition. Perhaps this was because he was 5½ feet tall. Fighting was his thing. It was where he lived. He did not hesitate to volunteer. He couldn't wait to get started. Ron Davis, the second black man on the list and the youngest of them all, did hesitate. He arrived in Dallas early that evening and was taken straight to EDS headquarters on Forest Lane. He had never met Perot, but had talked to him on the phone from Tehran during the evacuation. For a few days during that period, they had kept a phone line open between Dallas and Tehran all day and all night. Someone had to sleep with a phone to his ear at the Tehran end, and frequently the job had fallen to Davis. One time, Perot himself had come on the line. Ron, I know it's bad over there, and we sure appreciate you staying. Now, is there anything I can do for you? Davis was surprised. He was only doing what his friends were doing, and he did not expect a special thank you. But he did have a special worry. My wife has conceived, and I haven't seen her for a while, he told Perot. If you could have someone call her and tell her I'm okay, and I'll be home as soon as possible, I'd appreciate it. Davis had been surprised to learn from Marva later that Perot had not had someone call her. He had called himself. Now meeting Perot for the first time, Davis was once again impressed. Perot shook his hand warmly and said, Hi, Ron, how are you? Just as if they'd been friends for years. However, listening to Perot's speech about loss of life, Davis had doubts. He wanted to know more about the rescue. He would be glad to help Paul and Bill, but he needed to be assured that the whole project would be well organized and professional. Perot told him about Bull Simons, and that settled it.
Perot was just so proud of them. Every single one had volunteered. He He sat in his office. It was dark outside. He was waiting for Simons. Smiling Jay Coburn, boyish Pat Scully, Joe Poche, the man of iron, Ralph Boulware, tall, black, and skeptical, mild-mannered Glenn Jackson, Jim Schwabach, the scrapper, Ron Davis, the comedian. Every single one. He was grateful as well as proud, for the burden they had shouldered was more his than theirs. One way and another, it had been quite a day. Simons had agreed instantly to come and help. Paul Walker, an EDS security man who had, coincidentally, served with Simons in Laos, had jumped on a plane in the middle of the night and flown to Red Bay to take care of Simons's pigs and dogs. And seven young executives had dropped everything at a moment's notice and agreed to take off for Iran to organize a jailbreak. They were now down the hall in the EDS boardroom, waiting for Simons, who had checked into the Hilton Inn and gone to dinner with T.J. Marquez and Merv Stauffer. Perot thought about Stauffer. Stocky, but spectacled, 40 years old, an economics graduate, Stauffer was Perot's right-hand man. He could remember vividly their first meeting, when he had interviewed Stauffer. A graduate of some college in Kansas, Merv had looked right off the farm in his cheap coat and slacks. He'd been wearing white socks. During the interview, Perot had explained, as gently as he knew how, that white socks were not appropriate clothing for a business meeting. But the socks were the only mistake Stauffer had made. He impressed Perot as being smart, tough, organized, and used to hard work. As the years went by, Perot had learned that Stauffer had yet more useful talents. He had a wonderful mind for detail, something Perot lacked. He was completely unflappable, and he was a great diplomat. When EDS landed a contract, it often meant taking over an existing data processing department with its staff. This could be difficult. The staff was naturally wary, touchy, and sometimes resentful. Merv Stauffer, calm, smiling, helpful, soft-spoken, gently determined, could smooth their feathers like no one else. Since the late 60s, he had been working directly with Perot. His specialty was taking a hazy, crazy idea from Perot's restless imagination, thinking it through, putting the pieces together, and making it work. Occasionally, he would conclude that the idea was impracticable. And when Stauffer said that, Perot began to think that maybe it was impracticable. His appetite for work was enormous. Even among the workaholics on the seventh floor, Stauffer was exceptional. As well as doing whatever Perot had dreamed up in bed the previous night, he supervised Perot's real estate company and his oil company, managed Perot's investments, and planned Perot's estate. The best way to help Simons, Perot decided, would be to give him Merv Stauffer. He wondered whether Simons had changed. It had been years since they last met. The occasion had been a banquet. Simons had told him a story. During the Sontai raid, Simons's helicopter had landed in the wrong place. It was a compound very like the prison camp, but some 400 yards distant, and it contained a barracks full of sleeping enemy soldiers. Awakened by the noise and the flares, the soldiers had begun to stumble out of the barracks, sleepy, half-dressed, carrying their weapons. Simons had stood outside the door with a lighted cigar in his mouth. Beside him was a burly sergeant. As each man came through the door, he would see the glow of Simons' cigar and hesitate. Simons would shoot him. The sergeant would heave the corpse aside, then they would wait for the next one. Perot had been unable to resist the question, "How many men did you kill?" "Must have been 70 or 80," Simons had said in the matter-of-fact voice. Simons had been a great soldier, but now he was a pig farmer. Was he still fit? He was 60 years old, and he had suffered a stroke even before Sontai. Did he still have a sharp mind? Was he still a great leader of men? He would want total control of the rescue, Perot was certain. The colonel would do it his way, or not at all. That suited Perot just fine. It was his way to hire the best man for the job, then let him get on with it. But was Simons still the greatest rescuer in the world? He heard voices in the outer office. They had arrived. He stood up and Simons walked in with T.J. Marquez and Merv Stauffer. "Colonel Simons, how are you?" said Perot. He never called Simons Bull. He thought it was corny. "Hello, Ross," said Simons, shaking hands. The handshake was firm. Simons was dressed casually in khaki pants. His shirt collar was open, showing the muscles of his massive neck. He looked older, more lines in that aggressive face, more gray in the crew-cut hair, which was also longer than Perot had ever seen it. But he seemed fit and hard. He still had the same deep, tobacco-roughened voice, with a faint but clear trace of a New York accent. He was carrying the folders Coburn had put together on the volunteers. "Sit down," said Perot. "Did you all have dinner?" "We went to Dusty's," said Stauffer. Simon said, "When was the last time this room was swept for bugs?" Perot smiled. Simons was still sharp, as well as fit. "Good," he replied. "It's never been swept, Colonel. From now on, I want every room we use to be swept every day." Stauffer said, "I'll see to that." Perot said, "Whatever you need, Colonel, just tell Merv." Now let's talk business for a minute. We sure appreciate you coming here to help us, and we'd like to offer you some compensation. Don't even think about it, Simon said gruffly.
Well,
I don't want payment for rescuing Americans in trouble, Simon said. I never got a bonus for it yet, and I don't want to start now.
Simon was offended. The force of his displeasure filled the room. Perrault backed off quickly. Simon was one of the very few people of whom he was wary.
The old warrior hasn't changed a bit, Perrault thought.
Good.
The team is waiting for you in the boardroom. I see you have the folders, but I know you'll want to make your own assessment of the men. They all know Tehran, and they all have either military experience or some skill that may be useful. But in the end, the choice of the team is up to you. If for any reason you don't like these men, we'll get some more. You're in charge here.
Perrault hoped Simons would not reject anyone, but he had to have the option.
Simons stood up. Let's go to work.
TJ hung back after Simons and Stauffer left. He said in a low voice, his wife died.
Lucille?
Perrault had not heard.
I'm sorry. Cancer.
How did he take it? Did you get an idea?
TJ nodded. Bad.
As TJ went out, Perrault's 20-year-old son, Ross Jr., walked in. It was common for Perrault's children to drop by the office, but this time, when a secret meeting was in session in the boardroom, Perrault wished his son had chosen another moment. Ross Jr. must have seen Simons in the hall. The boy had met Simons before and knew who he was. By now, Perrault thought, he's figured out that the only reason for Simons to be here is to organize a rescue.
Ross sat down and said, Hi, Dad. I've been by to see Grandmother.
Good, Perrault said.
He looked fondly at his only son. Ross Jr. was tall, broad-shouldered, slim, and a good deal better looking than his father. Girls clustered around him like flies. The fact that he was heir to a fortune was only one of the attractions. He handled it the way he handled everything, with immaculate good manners and a maturity beyond his years.
Perrault said, You and I need to have a clear understanding about something. I expect to live to be 100, but if anything should happen to me, I want you to leave college and come home and take care of your mother and your sisters.
I would, Ross said. Don't worry.
And if anything should happen to your mother, I want you to live at home and raise your sisters. I know it would be hard on you, but I wouldn't want you to hire people to do it. They would need you, a member of the family. I'm counting on you to live at home with them and see they're properly raised.
Dad, that's what I would have done if you'd never brought it up.
Good. The boy got up to go. Perrault walked to the door with him. Suddenly, Ross put his arm around his father and said, Love you, Pop. Perrault hugged him back. He was surprised to see tears in his son's eyes. Ross went out.
Perrault sat down. He should not have been surprised by those tears. The Perrault's were a close family, and Ross was a warm-hearted boy.
Perrault had no specific plans to go to Tehran, but he knew that if his men were going there to risk their lives, he would not be far behind. Ross Jr. had known the same thing.
The whole family would support him, Perrault knew. Margot might be entitled to say, While you're risking your life for your employees, what about us? But she would never say it. All through the Prisoners of War campaign, when he'd gone to Vietnam and Laos, when he'd tried to fly into Hanoi, when the family had been forced to live with bodyguards, they had never complained, never said, What about us? On the contrary, they had encouraged him to do whatever he saw to be his duty. While he sat thinking, Nancy, his eldest daughter, walked in.
Poops, she said.
It was her pet name for her father.
Little Nan, come in.
She came around the desk and sat on his lap. Perrault adored Nancy. 18 years old, blonde, tiny but strong. She reminded him of his mother. She was determined and hard-headed, like Perrault. And she probably had as much potential to be a business executive as her brother.
I came to say goodbye. I'm going back to Vanderbilt.
Did you drop by Grandmother's house?
I sure did.
Good girl.
She was in high spirits, excited about going back to school, oblivious of the tension and the talk of death here on the 7th floor.
How about some extra funds, she said.
Perrault smiled indulgently and took out his wallet. As usual, he was helpless to resist her. She pocketed the money, hugged him, kissed his cheek, jumped off his lap, and bounced out of the room without a care in the world. This time, there were tears in Perrault's eyes.
It was like a reunion, Jay Coburn thought. The old Tehran hands in the boardroom waiting for Simons, chatting about Iran and the evacuation. There was Ralph Boulware talking at 90 miles an hour, Joe Pache sitting and thinking, looking about as animated as a robot in a sulk. Glenn Jackson saying something about rifles. Jim Schwabach smiling his lopsided smile, the smile that made you think he knew something you didn't. And Pat Scully talking about the Sun Tai raid. They all knew now that they were about to meet the legendary Bull Simons. Scully, when he had been a ranger instructor, had taught Simons' famous raid, and he knew all about the meticulous planning, the endless rehearsals, and the fact that Simons had brought back all his 59 men alive. The door opened, and a voice said, "All stand!" They pushed back their chairs and stood up. Coburn looked around. Ron Davis walked in, grinning all over his black face. "God damn you, Davis," said Coburn, and they all laughed as they realized they'd been fooled. Davis walked around the room, slapping hands and saying hello. That was Davis, always the clown. Coburn looked at all of them and wondered how they would change when faced with physical danger. Combat was a funny thing. You could never predict how people would cope with it. The man you thought the bravest would crumble, and the one you expected to run scared would be solid as a rock. Coburn would never forget what combat had done to him. The crisis had come a couple of months after he arrived in Vietnam. He was flying support aircraft called Slicks because they had no weapons systems. 6 times that day, he had come out of the battle zone with a full load of troops. It had been a good day. Not a shot had been fired at his helicopter. The 7th time was different. A burst of 12.75 fire hit the aircraft and severed the tail rotor drive shaft. When the main rotor of a helicopter turns, the body of the aircraft has a natural tendency to turn in the same direction. The function of the tail rotor is to counteract this tendency. If the tail rotor stops, the helicopter starts spinning. Immediately after takeoff, when the aircraft is only a few feet off the ground, the pilot can deal with tail rotor loss by landing again before the spinning becomes too fast. Later, when the aircraft is at cruising height and normal flying speed, the flow of wind across the fuselage is strong enough to prevent the helicopter turning. But Coburn was at a height of 150 feet, the worst possible position, too high to land quickly, but not yet traveling fast enough for the wind flow to stabilize the fuselage. The standard procedure was a simulated engine stall. Coburn had learned and rehearsed the routine at flying school, and he went into it instinctively, but it did not work. The aircraft was already spinning too fast. Within seconds, he was so dizzy, he had no idea where he was. He was unable to do anything to cushion the crash landing. The helicopter came down on its right skid, he learned afterwards, and one of the rotor blades flexed down under the impact, slicing through the fuselage and into the head of his co-pilot, who died instantly. Coburn smelled fuel and unstrapped himself. That was when he realized he was upside down, for he fell on his head. But he got out of the aircraft, his only injury, a few compressed neck vertebrae. His crew chief also survived. The crew had been belted in, but the 7 troops in the back had not. The helicopter had no doors, and the centrifugal force of the spin had thrown them out at a height of more than 100 feet. They were all dead. Coburn was 20 years old at the time. A few weeks later, he took a bullet in the calf, the most vulnerable part of the helicopter pilot, who sits in an armored seat but leaves his lower legs exposed. He had been angry before, but now he just had the ass. Pissed off with being shot at, he went in to his commanding officer and demanded to be assigned to gunships so that he could kill some of those bastards down there who were trying to kill him. His request was granted. That was the point at which smiling Jay Coburn had turned into a cool-headed, cold-hearted professional soldier. He made no close friends in the Army. If someone in the unit was wounded, Coburn would shrug and say, "Well, that's what he gets combat pay for." He suspected his comrades thought he was a little sick. He did not care. He was happy flying gunships. Every time he strapped himself in, he knew he was going out there to kill or be killed. Clearing out areas in advance of ground troops, knowing that women and children and innocent civilians were getting hurt, Coburn just closed his mind and opened fire. 11 years later, looking back, he could think, "I was an animal." Schwabach and Pochet, the 2 quietest men in the room, would understand. They had been there. They knew how it had been. The others did not. Scully, Bull Ware, Jackson, and Davis. If this rescue turns nasty, Coburn wondered again, how will they make out? The room fell silent as Simons walked to the head of the conference table. "He's a big son of a bitch," Coburn thought. T.J. Marcus and Merv Stauffer came in after Simons and sat near the door. Simons threw a black plastic suitcase into a corner, dropped into a chair, and lit a small cigar. He was casually dressed in a shirt and pants, no tie, and his hair was long for a colonel. He looked more like a farmer than a soldier, Coburn thought. He said, "I'm Colonel Simons." Coburn expected him to say, "I'm in charge, listen to me, and do what I say, this is my plan." Instead, he started asking questions. He wanted to know all about Tehran. The weather, the traffic, what the buildings were made of, the people in the streets, the numbers of policemen, and how they were armed. He was interested in every detail. They told him that all the police were armed except the traffic cops. How could you distinguish them? By their white hats. They told him there were blue cabs and orange cabs. What was the difference? The blue cabs had fixed routes and fixed fares. Orange cabs would go anywhere, in theory, but usually, when they pulled up, there was already a passenger inside, and the driver would ask which way you were headed. If you were going his way, you could get in, and note the amount already on the meter. Then when you got out, you paid the increase. The system was an endless source of arguments with cabbies. Simons asked where exactly the jail was located. Merv Stauffer went to find street maps of Tehran. What did the building look like? Joe Pesce and Ron Davis both remember driving past it. Pesce sketched it on an easel pad. Coburn sat back and watched Simons work. Picking the men's brains was only half of what he was up to, Coburn realized. Coburn had been an EDS recruiter for years, and he knew a good interviewing technique when he saw it. Simons was sizing up each man, watching reactions, testing for common sense. Like a recruiter, he asked a lot of open-ended questions, often following with why, giving people an opportunity to reveal themselves, to brag or bullshit or show signs of anxiety. Coburn wondered whether Simons would flunk any of them. At one point he said, "Who is prepared to die doing this?" Nobody said a word. "Good," said Simons. "I wouldn't take anyone who was planning on dying." The discussion went on for hours. Simons broke it up soon after midnight. It was clear by then that they did not know enough about the jail to begin planning the rescue. Coburn was deputized to find out more overnight. He would make some phone calls to Tehran. Simons said, "Can you ask people about the jail without letting them know why you want the information?" "I'll be discreet," Coburn said. Simons turned to Merv Stauffer. "We'll need a secure place for us all to meet. Somewhere that isn't connected with EDS. What about the hotel? The walls are thin." Stauffer considered for a moment. "Ross has a little house at Lake Grapevine out toward DFW Airport. There won't be anyone out there swimming or fishing in this weather, that's for sure." Simons looked dubious. Stauffer said, "Why don't I drive you out there in the morning so you can look it over?" "Okay." Simons stood up. "We've done all we can at this point in the game." They began to drift out. As they were leaving, Simons asked Davis for a word in private. "You ain't so goddamn tough, Davis." Ron Davis stared at Simons in surprise. "What makes you think you're a tough guy?" Simons said. Davis was floored. All evening, Simons had been polite, reasonable, quiet-spoken. Now he was making like he wanted to fight. What was happening? Davis thought of his martial arts expertise and of the three muggers he had disposed of in Tehran, but he said, "I don't consider myself a tough guy." Simons acted as if he had not heard. "Against a pistol, your karate is no bloody good whatsoever." "I guess not. This team does not need any bad black bastards spoiling for a fight." Davis began to see what this was all about. "Keep cool," he told himself. "I did not volunteer for this because I want to fight people, Colonel. Then why did you volunteer?" "Because I know Paul and Bill and their wives and children, and I want to help." Simons nodded dismissively. "I'll see you tomorrow." Davis wondered whether that meant he had passed the test. In the afternoon on the next day, January 3rd, 1979, they all met at Perot's weekend house on the shore of Lake Grapevine. The two or three other houses nearby appeared empty, as Merv Stauffer had predicted. Perot's house was screened by several acres of rough woodland and had lawns running down to the water's edge. It was a compact wood frame building, quite small. The garage for Perot's speedboats was bigger than the house. The door was locked and nobody had thought to bring the keys. Schwebach picked a window lock and let them in. There was a living room, a couple of bedrooms, a kitchen, and a bathroom. The place was cheerfully decorated in blue and white with inexpensive furniture. The men sat around the living room with their maps and easel pads and magic markers and cigarettes. Coburn reported. Overnight he had spoken to Majid and two or three other people in Tehran. It had been difficult trying to get detailed information about the jail while pretending to be only mildly curious, but he thought he had succeeded. The jail was part of the Ministry of Justice complex, which occupied a whole city block, he had learned. The jail entrance was at the rear of the block. Next to the entrance was a courtyard, separated from the street only by a 12-foot-high fence of iron railings. This courtyard was the prisoner's exercise area. Clearly, it was also the prison's weak point. Simons agreed. All they had to do then was wait for an exercise period, get over the fence, grab Paul and Bill, bring them back over the fence, and get out of Iran. They got down to details. How would they get over the fence? Would they use ladders or climb on each other's shoulders? They would arrive in a van, they decided, and use its roof as a step. Traveling in a van rather than a car had another advantage. Nobody would be able to see inside while they were driving to, and more importantly, away from, the jail. Joe Pesce was nominated driver because he knew the streets of Tehran best. How would they deal with the prison guards? They did not want to kill anyone. They had no quarrel with the Iranian man in the street or with the guards. It was not the fault of those people that Paul and Bill were unjustly imprisoned. Furthermore, if there was any killing, the subsequent hue and cry would be worse, making escape from Iran more hazardous. But the prison guards would not hesitate to shoot them. The best defense, Simon said, was a combination of surprise, shock, and speed. They would have the advantage of surprise. For a few seconds, the prison guards would not understand what was happening. Then the rescuers would have to do something to make the guards take cover. Shotgun fire would be best. A shotgun would make a big flash and a lot of noise, especially in a city street. The shock would cause the guards to react defensively instead of attacking the rescuers. That would give them a few more seconds. With speed, those seconds might be enough. And then they might not. The room filled with tobacco smoke as the plan took shape. Simons sat there, chain-smoking his little cigars, listening, asking questions, guiding the discussion. This was a very democratic army, Coburn thought. As they got involved in the plan, his friends were forgetting about their wives and children, their mortgages, their lawnmowers and station wagons, forgetting, too, how outrageous was the very idea of their snatching prisoners out of a jail. Davis stopped clowning. Scully no longer seemed boyish, but became very cold and calculating. Pochet wanted to talk everything to death, as usual. Bulwer was skeptical, as usual. Afternoon wore into evening. They decided the van would pull onto the sidewalk beside the iron railings. This sort of parking would not be in the least remarkable in Tehran, they told Simons. Simons would be sitting in the front seat beside Pochet with a shotgun beneath his coat. He would jump out and stand in front of the van. The back door of the van would open, and Ralph Bulwer would get out, also with a shotgun under his coat. So far, nothing out of the ordinary would appear to have happened. With Simons and Bulwer ready to give covering fire, Ron Davis would get out of the van, climb onto the roof, step from the roof to the top of the fence, and then jump down into the courtyard. Davis was chosen for this role because he was the youngest and fittest, and the jump, a 12-foot drop, would be hard to take. Coburn would follow Davis over the fence. He was not in good shape, but his face was more familiar than any other to Paul and Bill, so they would know as soon as they saw him that they were being rescued. Next, Bulwer would lower a ladder into the courtyard. Surprise might take them this far if they were quick, but at this point the guards were sure to react. Simons and Bulwer would now fire their shotguns into the air. The prison guards would hit the dirt. The Iranian prisoners would run around in terrified confusion, and the rescuers would have gained a few more seconds. What if there were interference from outside the jail, Simons asked? From police, or soldiers in the street, revolutionary rioters, or just public-spirited passers-by? There would be two flanking guards, they decided. One at either end of the street. They would arrive in a car a few seconds before the van. They would be armed with handguns. Their job was simply to stop anyone who came to interfere with the rescue. Jim Schwabach and Pat Scully were nominated. Coburn was sure Schwabach would not hesitate to shoot people if necessary. And Scully, although he had never in his life shot anyone, had become so surprisingly ice-cool during the discussion that Coburn supposed he would be equally ruthless. Glenn Jackson would drive the car. The question of Glenn the Baptist shooting people would not arise. Meanwhile, in the confusion in the courtyard, Ron Davis would provide close cover, dealing with any nearby guards, while Coburn cut Paul and Bill out of the herd and urged them up the ladder. They would jump from the top of the fence to the roof of the van, then from there to the ground, and finally inside the van. Coburn would follow, then Davis. "Hey, I'm taking the biggest risk of all," said Davis. "Hell, I'm first in and last out. Maximum exposure." "No shit," said Bulwer. "Next question." Simons would get into the front of the van, Bulwer would jump in the back and close the door, and Pochet would drive them away at top speed. Jackson, in the car, would pick up the flanking guards, Schwabach and Scully, and follow the van. During the getaway, Bulwer would be able to shoot through the back window of the van, and Simons would cover the road ahead. Any really serious pursuit would be taken care of by Scully and Schwabach in the car. At a prearranged spot, they would dump the van and split up in several cars, then head for the airbase at Doshen Tope on the outskirts of the city. A U.S. Air Force jet would fly them out of Iran. It would be Perot's job to arrange that somehow. At the end of the evening, they had the skeleton of a workable plan. Before they left, Simons told them not to talk about the rescue, not to their wives, not even to each other, outside the lake house. They should each think up a cover story to explain why they would be going out of the U.S. in a week or so. And, he added, looking at their full ashtrays and their ample waistlines, each man should devise his own exercise program for getting in shape. The rescue was no longer a zany idea in Ross Perot's mind. It was real. Jay Coburn was the only one who made a serious effort to deceive his wife. He went back to the Hilton Inn and called Liz. "Hi, honey." "Hi, Jay. Where are you?" "I'm in Paris." Joe Pochet also called his wife from the Hilton. "Where are you?" she asked him. "I'm in Dallas." "What are you doing?" "Working at EDS, of course." "Joe, EDS in Dallas has been calling me to ask where you are." Pochet realized that someone who was not in on the secret of the rescue team had been trying to locate him. "I'm not working with those guys. I'm working directly with Ross. Somebody forgot to tell someone else, that's all." "What are you working on?" "It has to do with some things that have to be done for Paul and Bill." "Oh, When Boulware got back to the home of his friends with whom his family was staying, his daughters, Stacy Elaine and Keisha Nicole, were asleep. His wife said, "How was your day?" "I've been planning a jailbreak," Boulware thought. He said, "Oh, okay." She looked at him strangely. "Well, what did you do?" "Nothing much." "For someone who is doing nothing much, you've been pretty busy. I called 2 or 3 times. They said they couldn't find you." "I was around. Hey, I think I'd like a beer." Mary Boulware was a warm, open woman to whom deceit was foreign. She was also intelligent, but she knew that Ralph had some firm ideas about the roles of husband and wife. The ideas might be old-fashioned, but they worked in this marriage. If there was an area of his business life that he didn't want to tell her about, well, she wasn't about to fight him over it. One beer, coming up. Jim Schwabach did not try to fool his wife, Rachel. She had already outguessed him. When Schwabach had got the original call from Pat Scully, Rachel had asked, "Who was that?" "That was Pat Scully in Dallas. They want me to go down there and work on a study in Europe." Rachel had known Jim for almost 20 years. They had started dating when he was 16, she 18, and she could read his mind. She said, "They're going back over there to get those guys out of jail." Schwabach said feebly, "Rachel, you don't understand. I'm out of that line of business. I don't do that anymore." "That's what you're going to do." Pat Scully could not lie successfully even to his colleagues, and with his wife he did not try. He told Mary everything. Ross Perot told Margot everything. And even Simons, who had no wife to pester him, broke security by telling his brother Stanley in New Jersey. It proved equally impossible to keep the rescue plan from other senior executives at EDS. The first to figure it all out was Keen Taylor, the tall, irritable, well-dressed ex-Marine whom Perot had turned around in Frankfurt and sent back to Tehran. Since that New Year's Day when Perot had said, "I'm sending you back to do something very important," Taylor had been sure that a secret operation was being planned, and it did not take him long to figure out who was doing it. One day, on the phone from Tehran to Dallas, he had asked for Ralph Boulware. "Boulware's not here," he was told. "When will he be back?" "We're not sure." Taylor, never a man to suffer fools gladly, had raised his voice. "So where has he gone?" "We're not sure." "What do you mean you're not sure?" "He's on vacation." Taylor had known Boulware for years. It had been Taylor who gave Boulware his first management opportunity. They were drinking partners. Many times Taylor, drinking himself sober with Ralph in the early hours of the morning, had looked around and realized his was the only white face in an all-black bar. Those nights, they would stagger back to whichever of their homes was nearest, and the unlucky wife who welcomed them would call the other and say, "It's okay, they're here." Yes, Taylor knew Boulware, and he found it hard to believe that Ralph would go on vacation while Paul and Bill were still in jail. The next day, he asked for Pat Scully and got the same runaround. Boulware and Scully on vacation while Paul and Bill were in jail? Bullshit. The next day, he asked for Coburn. Same story. It was beginning to make sense. Coburn had been with Perot when Perot sent Taylor back to Tehran. Coburn, director of personnel, evacuation mastermind, would be the right choice to organize a secret operation. Taylor and Rich Gallagher, the other EDS man still in Tehran, started making a list. Boulware, Scully, Coburn, Ron Davis, Jim Schwabach, and Joe Pache were all on vacation. That group had a few things in common. When Paul Schiaparoni had first come to Tehran, he found that EDS's operation there was not organized to his liking. It had been too loose, too casual, too Persian. The ministry contract had not been running to time. Paul had brought in a number of tough, down-to-earth EDS troubleshooters, and together they had knocked the business back into shape. Taylor himself had been one of Paul's tough guys. So had Bill Gaylord. And Coburn, and Scully, and Boulware, and all the guys who were now on vacation. The other thing they had in common was that they were all members of the EDS Tehran Roman Catholic Sunday Brunch Poker School. Like Paul and Bill, like Taylor himself, they were Catholics, with the exception of Joe Pache and of Glenn Jackson, the only rescue team member Taylor failed to spot. Each Sunday, they had met at the Catholic Mission in Tehran. After the service, they would all go to the house of one of them for brunch. And while the wives were cooking and the children playing, the men would get into a poker game. There was nothing like poker for revealing a man's true character. If, as Taylor and Gallagher now suspected, Perot had asked Coburn to put together a team of completely trustworthy men, then Coburn was sure to have picked them from the poker school. "Vacation my ass," Taylor said to Gallagher. "This is a rescue team." The rescue team returned to the lake house on the morning of January 4th and went over the whole plan again. Simons had endless patience for detail, and he was determined to prepare for every possible snag that anyone could dream up. He was much helped by Joe Pache, whose tireless questioning, wearying though it was to Coburn at least, was in fact highly creative, and led to numerous improvements of the rescue scenario. First, Simons was dissatisfied with the arrangement for protecting the rescue team's flanks. The idea of Schwabach and Scully, short but deadly, just plain shooting anyone who tried to interfere was crude. It would be better to have some kind of diversion to distract any police or military types who might be nearby. Schwebach suggested setting fire to a car down the street from the jail. Simons was not sure that would be enough. He wanted to blow up a whole building. Anyway, Schwebach was given the job of designing a time bomb. They thought of a small precaution that would shave a second or two off the time for which they would be exposed. Simons would get out of the van some distance from the jail and walk up to the fence. If all was clear, he would give a hand signal for the van to approach. Another weak element of the plan was the business of getting out of the van and climbing on its roof. All that jumping out and scrambling up would use precious seconds. And would Paul and Bill, after weeks in prison, be fit enough to climb a ladder and jump off the roof of a van? All sorts of solutions were canvassed. An extra ladder, a mattress on the ground, grab handles on the roof. But in the end, the team came up with a simple solution. They would cut a hole in the roof of the van and get in and out through that. Another little refinement for those who had to jump back down through the hole was a mattress on the floor of the van to soften their landing. The getaway journey would give them time to alter their appearances. In Tehran, they planned to wear jeans and casual jackets, and they were all beginning to grow beards and mustaches to look less conspicuous there. But in the van, they would carry business suits and electric shavers, and before switching to the cars, they would all shave and change their clothes. Ralph Bulwer, independent as ever, did not want to wear jeans and a casual jacket beforehand. In a business suit with a white shirt and tie, he felt comfortable and able to assert himself, especially in Tehran, where good Western clothing labeled a man as a member of the dominant class in society. Simons calmly gave his assent. The most important thing, he said, was for everyone to feel comfortable and confident during the operation. At the Doshen Tope Air Base, from which they planned to leave on an Air Force jet, there were both American and Iranian planes and personnel. The Americans would, of course, be expecting them, but what if the Iranian sentries at the entrance gave them a hard time? They would all carry forged military identity cards, they decided. Some wives of EDS executives had worked for the military in Tehran and still had their ID cards. Merv Stauffer would get hold of one and use it as a model for the forgeries. Some wives of EDS executives had worked for the military in Tehran and still had their ID cards. Merv Stauffer would get hold of one and use it as a model for the forgeries. Throughout all this, Simons was still very low-key, Coburn observed, chain-smoking his cigars. Bulwer told him, "Don't worry about getting shot, you're going to die of cancer." He did little more than ask questions. The plans were made in roundtable discussion with everyone contributing, and decisions were arrived at by mutual agreement. Yet Coburn found himself coming to respect Simons more and more. The man was knowledgeable, intelligent, painstaking, and imaginative. He also had a sense of humor. Coburn could see that the others were also beginning to get the measure of Simons. If anyone asked a dumb question, Simons would give a sharp answer. In consequence, they would hesitate before asking a question and wonder what his reaction might be. In this way, he was getting them to think like him. Once on that second day at the lake house, they felt the full force of his displeasure. It was, not surprisingly, young Ron Davis who angered him. They were a humorous bunch, and Davis was the funniest. Coburn approved of that. Laughter helped ease the tension in an operation such as this. He suspected Simons felt the same, but one time Davis went too far. Simons had a pack of cigars on the floor beside his chair and five more packs out in the kitchen. Davis, getting to like Simons and characteristically making no secret of it, said with genuine concern, "Colonel, you smoke too many cigars. It's bad for your health." By way of reply, he got the Simons look, but he ignored the warning. A few minutes later, he went into the kitchen and hid the five packs of cigars in the dishwasher. When Simons finished the first pack, he went looking for the rest and could not find them. He could not operate without tobacco. He was about to get in a car and go to a store when Davis opened the dishwasher and said, "I have your cigars here." "You keep those, goddammit," Simon growled, and he went out. When he came back with another five packs, he said to Davis, "These are mine. Keep your goddamn hands off them." Davis felt like a child who has been put in the corner. It was the first and last prank he played on Colonel Simons. While the discussion went on, Jim Schwebach sat on the floor, trying to make a bomb. To smuggle a bomb, or even just its component parts, through Iranian customs would have been dangerous. "That's a risk we don't have to take," Simon said. So Schwebach had to design a device that could be assembled from ingredients readily available in Tehran. The idea of blowing up a building was dropped. It was too ambitious and would probably kill innocent people. They would make do with a blazing car as a diversion. Schwebach knew how to make instant napalm from gasoline, soap flakes, and a little oil. The timer and the fuse were his two problems. In the States, he would have used an electrical timer connected with a toy rocket motor, but in Tehran, he would be restricted to more primitive mechanisms. Schwebach enjoyed the challenge. He liked fooling around with anything mechanical. His hobby was an ugly-looking stripped-down 73 Oldsmobile Cutlass that went like a bullet out of a gun. At first, he experimented with an old-fashioned clockwork stovetop timer that used a striker to hit a bell. He attached a phosphorus match to the striker and substituted a piece of sandpaper for the bell to ignite the match. The match, in turn, would light a mechanical fuse. The system was unreliable and caused great hilarity among the rest of the team, who jeered and laughed every time the match failed to ignite. In the end, Schwebach settled on the oldest timing device of all, a candle. He test-burned a candle to see how long it took to burn down 1 inch. Then he cut another candle off at the right length for 15 minutes. Next, he scraped the heads off several old-fashioned phosphorus matches and ground up the inflammable material into a powder. This he packed tightly into a piece of aluminum kitchen foil. Then he stuck the foil into the base of the candle. When the candle burned all the way down, it heated the aluminum foil, and the ground-up match heads exploded. The foil was thinner at the bottom so that the explosion would travel downward. The candle, with this primitive but reliable fuse in its base, was set into the neck of a plastic jar about the size of a hip flask full of jellied gasoline. "You light the candle and walk away from it," Schwebach told them when his design was complete. 15 minutes later, you've got a nice little fire going. And any police, soldiers, revolutionaries, or passers-by, plus, quite possibly, some of the prison guards, would have their attention fixed on a blazing automobile 300 yards up the street while Ron Davis and Jay Coburn were jumping over the fence into the prison courtyard. That day, they moved out of the Hilton Inn. Coburn slept at the Lake House, and the others checked into the airport marina, which was closer to Lake Grapevine, all except Ralph Bulwer, who insisted on going home to his family. They spent the next 4 days training, buying equipment, practicing their shooting, rehearsing the jailbreak, and further refining the plan. Shotguns could be bought in Tehran, but the only kind of ammunition allowed by the Shah was birdshot. However, Simons was expert at reloading ammunition, so they decided to smuggle their own shot into Iran. The trouble with putting buckshot into birdshot slugs would be that they would get relatively few shots into the smaller slugs. The ammunition would have great penetration, but little spread. They decided to use number 2 shot, which would spread wide enough to knock down more than one man at a time, but had enough penetration to smash the windshield of a pursuing car. In case things turned really nasty, each member of the team would also carry a Walther PPK in a holster. Merv Stauffer got Bob Snyder, head of security at EDS, and a man who knew when not to ask questions, to buy the PPKs at Ray's Sporting Goods in Dallas. Schwebach had the job of figuring out how to smuggle the guns into Iran. Stauffer inquired, which U.S. airports did not fluoroscope outgoing baggage? One was Kennedy. Schwebach bought 2 Vuitton trunks, deeper than ordinary suitcases, with reinforced corners and hard sides. With Coburn, Davis, and Jackson, he went to the woodwork shop at Perot's Dallas home and experimented with ways of constructing false bottoms in the cases. Schwebach was perfectly happy about carrying guns through Iranian customs in a false-bottom case. "If you know how customs people work, you don't get stopped," he said. His confidence was not shared by the rest of the team. In case he did get stopped and the guns were found, there was a fallback plan. He would say the case was not his. He would return to the baggage claim area, and there, sure enough, would be another Vuitton trunk just like the first, but full of personal belongings and containing no guns. Once the team was in Tehran, they would have to communicate with Dallas by phone. Coburn was quite sure the Iranians bugged the phone line, so the team developed a simple code. GR meant A, GS meant B, GT meant C, and so on through GZ, which meant I. Then HA meant J, HB meant K, through HR, which meant Z. Numbers 1 through 9 were IA through II, 0 was IJ. They would use the military alphabet, in which A is called Alpha, B is Bravo, C is Charlie, and so on. For speed, only key words would be coded. The sentence, "He is with EDS," would therefore become, "He is with Golf Victor Golf Uniform Hotel Kilo." Only 3 copies of the key to the code were made. Simons gave one to Merv Stauffer, who would be the team's contact here in Dallas. He gave the other 2 to Jay Coburn and Pat Scully, who, though nothing was said formally, were emerging as his lieutenants. The code would prevent an accidental leak through a casual phone tap, but, as computer men know better than anyone, such a simple letter cipher could be broken by an expert in a few minutes. As a further precaution, therefore, certain common words had special code groups. Paul was AG, Bill was AH, the American Embassy was GC, and Tehran was AU. Perot was always referred to as the chairman. Guns were tapes, the prison was the data center, Kuwait was oil town, Istanbul was resort, and the attack on the prison was Plan A. Everyone had to memorize these special code words. If anyone were questioned about the code, he was to say that it was used to abbreviate teletype messages. The code name for the whole rescue was Operation Hotfoot. It was an acronym dreamed up by Ron Davis. Help our 2 friends out of Tehran. Simons was tickled by that. "Hotfoot has been used so many times for operations," he said, "and this is the first time it's ever been appropriate." They rehearsed the attack on the prison at least 100 times. In the grounds of the lake house, Schwabach and Davis nailed up a plank between two trees at a height of 12 feet to represent the courtyard fence. Merv Stauffer brought them a van borrowed from EDS security. Time and time again, Simons walked up the fence and gave a hand signal. Pochet drove the van up and stopped it at the fence. Bulwer jumped out of the back. Davis got on the roof and jumped over the fence. Coburn followed. Bulwer climbed on the roof and lowered the ladder into the courtyard. Paul and Bill, played by Schwabach and Scully, who did not need to rehearse their roles as flanking guards, came up the ladder and over the fence, followed by Coburn and then Davis. Everyone scrambled into the van, and Pochet drove off at top speed. Sometimes they switched roles so that each man learned how to do everyone else's job. They prioritized tasks so that if one of them dropped out, wounded, or for any other reason, they knew automatically who would take his place. Schwabach and Scully, playing the parts of Paul and Bill, sometimes acted sick and had to be carried up the ladder and over the fence. The advantage of physical fitness became apparent during the rehearsals. Davis could come back over the fence in a second and a half, touching the ladder twice. Nobody else could do it anywhere near that fast. One time Davis went over too fast and landed awkwardly on the frozen ground, straining his shoulder. The injury was not serious, but it gave Simons an idea. Davis would travel to Tehran with his arm in a sling, carrying a beanbag for exercise. The bag would be weighted with number two shot. Simons timed the rescue from the moment the van stopped at the fence to the moment it pulled away with everyone inside. In the end, according to his stopwatch, they could do it in under 30 seconds. They practiced with the Walther PPKs at the Garland Public Shooting Range. They told the range operator that they were security men from all over the country on a course in Dallas, and they had to get their target practice in before they could go home. He did not believe them, especially after T.J. Marcus turned up looking just like a mafia chieftain in a movie with his black coat and black hat and took 10 Walther PPKs and 5,000 rounds of ammunition out of the trunk of his black Lincoln. After a little practice, they could all shoot reasonably well except Davis. Simons suggested he try shooting lying down, since that was the position he would be in when he was in the courtyard, and he found he could do much better that way. It was bitterly cold out in the open, and they all huddled in a little shack, trying to get warm while they were not shooting, all except Simons, who stayed outside all day long as if he were made of stone. He was not made of stone. When he got into Merv Stauffer's car at the end of the day, he said, "Jesus Christ, it's cold!" He had begun to needle them about how soft they were. They were always talking about where they would go to eat and what they would order, he said. When he was hungry, he would open a can. He would laugh at someone for nursing a drink. When he was thirsty, he would fill a tumbler with water and drink it all straight down, saying, "I didn't pour it to look at it." He showed them how he could shoot one time, every bullet in the center of the target. Once Coburn saw him with his shirt off, his physique would have been impressive on a man 20 years younger. It was a tough guy act, the whole performance. What was peculiar was that none of them ever laughed at it. With Simons, it was the real thing. One evening at the lake house, he showed them the best way to kill a man quickly and silently. He had ordered, and Merv Stauffer had purchased, Gerber knives for each of them, short stabbing weapons with a narrow, two-edged blade. "It's kind of small," said Davis, looking at his. "Is it long enough?" "It is unless you want to sharpen it when it comes out the other side," Simon said. He showed them the exact spot in the small of Glenn Jackson's back where the kidney was located. "A single stab, right there, is lethal," he said. "Wouldn't he scream?" Davis asked. "It hurts so bad he can't make a sound." While Simons was demonstrating, Merv Stauffer had come in, and now he stood in the doorway, open-mouthed, with a McDonald's paper bag on either arm. Simons saw him and said, "Look at this guy. He can't make a sound, and nobody's stuck him yet." Merv laughed and started handing round the food. "You know what the McDonald's girl said to me in a completely empty restaurant when I asked for 30 hamburgers and 30 orders of fries?" "What?" "What they always say. Is this to eat here? Let it go." Simons just loved working for private enterprise. One of his biggest headaches in the Army had always been supplies. Even planning the Sun Tai raid, an operation in which the president himself was personally interested, it had seemed as if he had had to fill in 6 requisition forms and get approval from 12 generals every time he needed a new pencil. Then, when all the paperwork was done, he would find that the items were out of stock, or there was a 4-month wait for delivery, or, worst of all, when the stuff came, it did not work. 22% of the blasting caps he ordered misfired. He had tried to get night sights for his raiders. He learned that the Army had spent 17 years trying to develop a night sight, but by 1970 all they had were 6 hand-built prototypes. Then he discovered a perfectly good British-made night sight available from the Armalite Corporation for $49.50, and that was what the Sun Tai raiders took to Vietnam. At EDS, there were no forms to be filled out and no permissions to be sought, at least not for Simons. He told Merv Stauffer what he needed, and Stauffer got it, usually the same day. He asked for and got 10 Walther PPKs and 10,000 rounds of ammunition, a selection of holsters, both left-handed and right-handed, in different styles, so the men could pick the kind they felt most comfortable with. Shotgun ammunition reloading kits in 12-gauge, 16-gauge, and 20-gauge. And cold-weather clothes for the team, including coats, mittens, shirts, socks, and woolen stocking caps. One day he asked for $100,000 in cash. 2 hours later, T.J. Marcus arrived at the lake house with the money in an envelope. It was different from the army in other ways. His men were not soldiers who could be bullied into submission. They were some of the brightest young corporate executives in the United States. He had realized from the start that he could not assume command. He had to earn their loyalty. These men would obey an order if they agreed with it. If not, they would discuss it. That was fine in the boardroom, but useless on the battlefield. They were squeamish, too. The first time they talked about setting fire to a car as a diversion, someone had objected on the grounds that innocent passers-by might get hurt. Simons needled them about their Boy Scout morality, saying they were afraid of losing their merit badges, and calling them "you Jack Armstrongs" after the too-good-to-be-true radio character who went around solving crimes and helping old ladies cross the road. They also had a tendency to forget the seriousness of what they were doing. There was a lot of joking and a certain amount of horseplay, particularly from young Ron Davis. A measure of humor was useful in a team on a dangerous mission, but sometimes Simons had to put a stop to it and bring them back to reality with a sharp remark. He gave them all the opportunity to back out at any time. He got Ron Davis on his own again and said, "You're going to be the first one over that fence. Don't you have some reservations about that?" "Yeah." "Good thing you do, otherwise I wouldn't take you. Suppose Paul and Bill don't come right away. Suppose they figure that if they head for the fence, they'll get shot. You'll be stuck there and the guards will see you. You'll be in bad trouble. Yeah? Me? I'm 60 years old. I've lived my life. Hell, I don't have a thing to lose. But you're a young man. And Marva's pregnant, isn't she?" "Yeah." "Are you really sure you want to do this?" "Yeah." He worked on them all. There was no point in his telling them that his military judgment was better than theirs. They had to come to that conclusion themselves. Similarly, his tough guy act was intended to let them know that from now on, such things as keeping warm, eating, drinking, and worrying about innocent bystanders would not occupy much of their time or attention. The shooting practice and the knife lesson also had a hidden purpose. The last thing Simons wanted was any killing on this operation, but learning how to kill reminded the men that the rescue could be a life-and-death affair. The biggest element in his psychological campaign was the endless practicing of the assault on the jail. Simons was quite sure that the jail would not be exactly as Coburn had described it, and that the plan would have to be modified. A raid never went precisely according to the scenario, as he knew better than most. The rehearsals for the Sun Tai raid had gone on for weeks. A complete replica of the prison camp had been built out of 2x4 timbers and target cloth at Eglin Air Base in Florida. The bloody thing had to be dismantled every morning before dawn and put up again at night, because the Russian reconnaissance satellite Cosmos 355 passed over Florida twice every 24 hours. But it had been a beautiful thing. Every goddamn tree and ditch in the Sun Tai prison camp had been reproduced in the mock-up. And then, after all those rehearsals, when they did it for real, one of the helicopters, the one Simons was in, had landed in the wrong place. Simons would never forget the moment he realized the mistake. His helicopter was taking off again, having discharged the raiders. A startled Vietnamese guard emerged from a foxhole, and Simons shot him in the chest. Shooting broke out, a flare went up, and Simons saw that the buildings surrounding him were not the buildings of the Sun Tai camp. "Get that fucking chopper back in here," he yelled to his radio operator. He told a sergeant to turn on a strobe light to mark the landing zone. He knew where they were, 400 yards from Sun Tai, in a compound marked on intelligence maps as a school. This was no school. There were enemy troops everywhere. It was a barracks, and Simons realized that his helicopter pilot's mistake had been a lucky one, for now he was able to launch a preemptive attack and wipe out a concentration of enemy troops who might otherwise have jeopardized the whole operation. That was the night he stood outside a barracks and shot 80 men in their underwear. No, an operation never went exactly according to plan, but becoming proficient at executing the scenario was only half the purpose of rehearsals anyway. The other half, and in the case of the EDS men, the important half, was learning to work together as a team. Oh, they were already terrific as an intellectual team. Give them each an office and a secretary and a telephone, and together they would computerize the world. But working together with their hands and their bodies was different. When they had started on January 3rd, they would have had trouble launching a rowboat as a team. 5 days later, they were a machine. And that was all that could be done here in Texas. Now they had to take a look at the real-life jail. It was time to go to Tehran. Simons told Stauffer he wanted to meet with Perot again.
While the rescue team was in training, President Carter got his last chance of preventing a bloody revolution in Iran. and he blew it. This is how it happened. Ambassador William Sullivan went to bed content on the night of January 4th, in his private apartment within the large, cool residence in the embassy compound at the corner of Roosevelt and Takhti Jamshid Avenues in Tehran. Sullivan's boss, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, had been busy with the Camp David negotiations all through November and December, but now he was back in Washington and concentrating on Iran, and boy, did it show. Vagueness and vacillation had ended. The cables containing Sullivan's instructions had become crisp and decisive. Most importantly, the United States at last had a strategy for dealing with the crisis. They were going to talk to the Ayatollah Khomeini. It was Sullivan's own idea. He was now sure that the Shah would soon leave Iran and Khomeini would return in triumph. His job, he believed, was to preserve America's relationship with Iran through the change of government, so that when it was all over, Iran would still be a stronghold of American influence in the Middle East. The way to do that was to help the Iranian armed forces to stay intact and to continue American military aid to any new regime. Sullivan had called Vance on the secure telephone line and told him just that. The U.S. should send an emissary to Paris to see the Ayatollah, Sullivan had urged. Khomeini should be told that the main concern of the U.S. was to preserve the territorial integrity of Iran and deflect Soviet influence, that the Americans did not want to see a pitched battle in Iran between the army and the Islamic revolutionaries, and that once the Ayatollah was in power, the U.S. would offer him the same military assistance and arms sales it had given the Shah. It was a bold plan. There would be those who would accuse the U.S. of abandoning a friend. But Sullivan was sure it was time for the Americans to cut their losses with the Shah and look to the future. To his intense satisfaction, Vance had agreed. So had the Shah. Weary, apathetic, and no longer willing to shed blood in order to stay in power, the Shah had not even put up a show of reluctance. Vance had nominated, as his emissary to the Ayatollah, Theodore H. Elliott, a senior diplomat who had served as economic counselor in Tehran and spoke Farsi fluently. Sullivan was delighted with the choice. Ted Elliott was scheduled to arrive in Paris in 2 days' time on January 6th. In one of the guest bedrooms at the ambassadorial residence, Air Force General Robert Dutch Heuser was also going to bed. Sullivan was not as enthusiastic about the Heuser mission as he was about the Elliott mission. Dutch Heuser, the deputy commander under Haig of U.S. forces in Europe, had arrived yesterday to persuade Iranian generals to support the new Bakhtiar government in Tehran. Sullivan knew Heuser. He was a fine soldier, but no diplomat. He spoke no Farsi, and he did not know Iran. But even if he had been ideally qualified, his task would have been hopeless. The Bakhtiar government had failed to gain the support even of the moderates, and Shahpur Bakhtiar himself had been expelled from the centrist National Front Party merely for accepting the Shah's invitation to form a government. Meanwhile, the army, which Heuser was trying futilely to swing to Bakhtiar, continued to weaken as thousands of soldiers deserted and joined the revolutionary mobs in the streets. The best Heuser could hope for was to hold the army together a little longer while Elliott in Paris arranged for the peaceful return of the Ayatollah. If it worked, it would be a great achievement for Sullivan, something any diplomat could be proud of for the rest of his life. His plan would have strengthened his country and saved lives. As he went to sleep, there was just one worry nagging at the back of his mind. The Elliott mission, for which he had such high hopes, was a State Department scheme, identified in Washington with Secretary of State Vance. The Heuser mission was the idea of Zbigniew Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor. The enmity between Vance and Brzezinski was notorious, and at this moment, Brzezinski, after a summit meeting in Guadalupe, was deep-sea fishing in the Caribbean with President Carter. As they sailed over the clear blue sea, what was Brzezinski whispering in the President's ear? The phone woke Sullivan in the early hours of the morning. It was the duty officer, calling from the communications vault in the embassy building just a few yards away. An urgent cable had arrived from Washington. The ambassador might want to read it immediately. Sullivan got out of bed and walked across the lawns to the embassy, full of foreboding. The cable said that the Elliott mission was canceled. The decision had been taken by the president. Sullivan's comment on the change of plan were not invited. He was instructed to tell the Shah that the United States government no longer intended to hold talks with the Ayatollah Khomeini. Sullivan was heartbroken. This was the end of America's influence in Iran. It also meant that Sullivan personally had lost his chance of distinguishing himself as ambassador by preventing a bloody civil war. He sent an angry message back to Vance, saying the president had made a gross mistake and should reconsider. He went back to bed, but he could not sleep. In the morning, another cable informed him that the president's decision would stand. Wearily, Sullivan made his way up the hill to the palace to tell the Shah. The Shah appeared drawn and tense that morning. He and Sullivan sat down and drank the inevitable cup of tea. Then Sullivan told him that President Carter had canceled the Elliott mission. The Shah was upset. "But why have they canceled it?" he said agitatedly. "I don't know," Sullivan replied. "But But how do they expect to influence those people if they won't even talk to them? I don't know. Then what does Washington intend to do now? Asked the Shah, throwing up his hands in despair. I don't know, said Sullivan.
Ross, this is idiotic, Tomlow said loudly. You're going to destroy the company, and you're going to destroy yourself.
Perot looked at his lawyer. They were sitting in Perot's office. The door was closed. Luce was not the first to say this. During the week, as the news had spread through the seventh floor, several of Perot's top executives had come in to tell him that a rescue team was a foolhardy and dangerous notion, and he should drop the idea. Stop worrying, Perot had told them. Just concentrate on what you have to do.
Tom Luce was characteristically vociferous. Wearing an aggressive scowl and a courtroom manner, he argued his case as if a jury were listening. I can only advise you on the legal situation, but I'm here to tell you that this rescue can cause more problems and worse problems than you've got now.
Hell, Ross, I can't make a list of the laws you're going to break.
Try, said Perot. You'll have a mercenary army, which is illegal here, in Iran, and in every country the team would pass through. Anywhere they'd go, they'd be liable to criminal penalties, and you could have 10 men in jail instead of 2.
But it's worse than that. Your men would be in a position much worse than soldiers in battle. International laws and the Geneva Convention, which protect soldiers in uniform, would not protect the rescue team. If they get captured in Iran, Ross, they'll be